to invalidate it or something like that. But it can't be appealed as a land use decision, I think, when you say no appeal opportunity, I mean, we live in a litigious enough society that anything can be appealed somewhere, but not through the land use process at all.
Okay. Thank you, Gordon. So we're going to jump into hearing procedures for legislative. Again, this is dealing with code amendments, modifications to plans. The hearing procedure can be applicant or staff initiated. Most of the time, at least in my experience, is typically the city or county would be the one making the recommendation or making the application to make a modification. However, it could potentially be somebody outside of a staff initiating it. There's notification that is mailed to landowners, which is a Measure 56 notification. All have opportunity to participate, meaning anybody who would like to can participate. There are no concerns with ex parte contact or bias, but there still is conflict of interest concerns that remain. And then there's a recommendation from the board or council to a recommendation from the Planning Commission to the board or council.
Can I just put that ex parte contact in lay terms? So if we're doing a plan amendment, you can talk to your neighbors about that. It's not like an individual property conditional use permit application, for example. And the CUP, if your neighbor or somebody stops you in the supermarket, you want to say, look, I have to make a decision on an individual property application. But if you're updating your code or your plan amendment, you can talk to anybody anytime about it. That's part of your role to be out there in the community. So really two different things.
Yes.
So for the legislative. And we encourage it. You
yes,
know.
Absolutely.
Have a card party and see what your neighbors think about. Or not.
Or not. So at the end of this slideshow, Gordon's going to jump pretty deep into conflicts, perceived conflicts, actual conflicts of interest. And I'm going to let his legal brain do all of the speaking because he does such a phenomenal job with it. So quasi-judicial hearing procedures. Before the public hearing, there's a pre-application discussion. Usually what that is like a pre-app meeting that in each jurisdiction can be different. It involves usually staffs and other affected agencies as well as an applicant to go over what kind of application requirements they have. Do you have something like that? Do you have a pre-application requirement?
Some require pre-app, some don't.
Some do not. Yeah. It depends on what
yeah.
the intensity
yeah.
of the use
yep.
is. Okay. The application is submitted and reviewed for completeness. Basically, review for completeness, application is submitted. The planner takes a look at it. If there are deficiencies in that application, they then let the applicant know that there's additional materials that do need to be submitted in order to be deemed complete. This one, I'm not sure what each local jurisdiction, my former jurisdiction was only 10 days prior.
City.
So is yours 20 days?
20.
Oh, it is? Okay. So notice is mailed at least 20 days prior to a hearing to applicants. So it's whatever your code says. So 20 sounds like 20 for county, maybe 10 for cities. As well as notification to property owners. And that, again, is directed by your code, your zoning code. It's going to be, usually they're like 100, 200, 500 feet. And sometimes that's based upon the intensity of the use. Conditional use permits or variances usually do have a larger radius that they notify. And then in addition, kind of similar to the pre-application, is recognized organizations and any other local agencies that would be involved or potentially impacted by an application.
I would just share with the Planning Commission that last piece, we have a checklist that has state, federal, local agencies on it, and it's really the planner or planners to say who has something at stake in a given application. It's usually a short list. If it's a legislative thing, it's usually a long list. And it's kind of a lot of responsibility. Like Landon's new, he's doing a wonderful job, but he said, do I have everybody on this list for, can't remember what the application was, and we chatted about it, but and we keep current names in various positions. It's always okay to over-notify, you don't want to under-notify and process a permit, and some agency said, well, you know, they need XYZ permit from whatever agency, and we didn't hear from you.
Great. And I think, again, kind of to reiterate what Tamara just said, it's okay to over-notice. And sometimes if there's any question, just notice. Just make sure you get that out. Because there have been surprises where somebody said, I didn't get a notice. Or they did get a notice and they just didn't comment within the time period. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The next one, in terms of decisions for quasi-judicial hearing notice, we have required contents. It's very detailed, explaining the nature of the application. Applicable criteria is required to be included in the notice. Street address and geographical reference. Sometimes it's like a vicinity. We have a great tool, or at least most planners across Oregon do, and it's our GIS system to map. And I will say, the mapping, when I first became a planner, we used to actually pull out the assessor maps, highlight, and mm-hmm. take the scale. And I mean, it's great to actually have a physical map that we can send. And most noticing, you guys do. Of course you do. Stephen does those. So date, time, and location of that public hearing. This is a big one. It's raise it or waive it. So that means if you have any questions, concerns, or issues, whether it be you as in your planning commission role or a citizen, you need to raise it or you're waiving that opportunity to provide that comment. The additional contact for additional information, usually that's going to the planner that's in charge of the application. Copy of the application and materials, basically they just ask that you have them available at no cost coming to the counter, or a copy for a reasonable cost, as well as the staff report being available for inspection at least 7 days prior to that hearing, available to review and or at a reasonable cost. With the internet anymore, or with email, I think. Do you guys email, or do you guys allow?
We email to agencies, but we don't have email addresses for adjacent property owners, so they get a paper copy.
But if they requested, they could do that?
Yep, okay, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Okay, so quasi-judicial decisions. So the hearing procedure, use a script, and I think you guys do have a script. Chair opens the hearing, describes the proceedings, the rules of conduct for the hearing. Again, the raise it or waive it statement is read. Right to continue if it's the first hearing. So that is a right that anyone can request that the hearing be continued. Announcement of the criteria that is used in the decision for the application. Declaration of any ex parte contact, bias, or conflict of interest. So that'll be asked of each planning commissioner. The staff report is usually presented by the planner, and then proposed findings and or recommendations are given.
Don or Gordon, I have a question. We normally have our chair read the prologue and then introduce a hearing. And if we have multiple applications, we don't repeat that piece. So we open that, she reads it, take action on a hearing, close a hearing, dispense, make a decision, and then we'll go to another application. Do we technically need to restate all of that first piece?
So
I mean, we do with the ex parte and conflict of interest, right. But the rest of it, do we?
So I'll let Gordon jump in if I, so my previous, in the Dalles, what our rule was is if nobody has entered the building after that original text was read.
Okay.
So if you have somebody that comes in for hearing number two and they did not
hear that
everything,
okay.
Then that was what we were advised to then have it reread in full.
Okay.
Gordon, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's a good rule, and even I would say you should do it anyway, just because you're very busy with things. You don't always know if there's been more people coming in for another meeting than for the hearing later. I think the safe thing to do is to read it each time, although
okay.
I know that can be
tedious,
but tedium is part of the job, I think, to some extent, unfortunately.
Size of the hearing.
So we did actually, we had in my former job, one of our historic landmark commissioners that had a difficult time saying ex parte. So we actually were going to record it so that we could just play the recording, and then all he had to do was read the application. So I don't know if I'm sure as long as you have all of the required script, I think that could potentially be an option too. So.
We can usually tell when somebody comes in unless it's a meeting like the last.
Our hearing
starts up. Oh, okay. Well, you never know. I don't know.
Sometimes.
I've been to one or two that have been a little large. So still, I'm using the script, so testimony, quasi-judicial. Oh, is this the same one? Oh, okay, oh, no, we're just continuing, sorry. Testimony, time, place, manner are set by the commission rules. And again, I'm mentioning the continuance. There's a, if it's the first meeting or first hearing, anyone can request a continuance to leave the record open, and it's automatically at least 7 days. At the end of the hearing, the chair closes that public hearing. There's a decision. There's like four parts included with the decision, which includes discussion, or motion and second, a deliberation and amendments to a motion, and then a vote. And then after the hearing, written findings. And sometimes what that can include is the findings that you adopt, the findings that the planner had provided in their staff recommendation and or staff report.
We usually advise the planning commission to adopt the findings or findings as amended.
As amended, okay.
And then we just finalize them and send them out for signature.
That's how I used to do it.
Okay.
And that's
okay.
I think it's great. Saves time.
The request for continuance, that comes from another board commissioner or
the public?
Public, right. So a public applicant.
Does it have to be the applicant, or could it be anybody in attendance?
Anybody.
I think anybody in attendance. And Gordon, can a planning commissioner request that a continuance to leave the record open?
I think that's subject to a majority of the commission. But any member of the public or the applicant, if they request the continuance, it has to be granted for at least 7 days.
The commission vote on whether to grant the continuance?
It's automatic. So you would have to.
Yeah,
for
the first hearing.
If you don't grant it, the person can appeal your decision on a procedural basis and get it sent back to you so you can do it again. So it's
that's for like, oh, this is what this is about. So I want to have time to go.
Yeah, because sometimes people, if it's not the first hearing and it's the second hearing, but there's new information presented, somebody may request a continuance, and then you have to, the Planning Commission has the ability to grant or not grant them that.
Correct.
That's why we, in this earlier slide, provide public notice and legal notice. So, and the entire record, anything that we have, is available 7 days prior to the hearing. You get a lot in your packet, but there's usually stuff that's not in your packet.
So that's when the 7-day continuance is granted, is before the hearing.
The continuance would happen at the hearing. But the record that we have, that we need to share to the public, has to be available 7 days prior. And if it's not, that's automatic grounds to continue the hearing. You get your packets, now that we email them all to you, you get your packets usually 10 days prior, because we had to adjust for U.S. Post was a little slow, but now everybody gets an electronic packet. But we send adjoining property owner notice prior to that. So if an adjoining property owner said, hey, I got this notice, they don't get the full packet that you have, but they're like, I'm kind of interested in this, what's it all about? And we'll say, oh, come on in, we'll make you a copy, or we'll email you a copy of it. And that has to be available 7 days prior, so they have a full week to look at it. And if we don't have it ready, we would say, that landowner or interested party, we could grant a continuance.
Okay, so Gordon did touch a little bit on this earlier, the 120-day rule. So final action on any quasi-judicial applications require 120 days on properties that are located inside an urban growth boundary, and then 150 for those that are outside an urban growth boundary. So that 120-day clock starts the day that is deemed complete. And it is very important for the planners and staff to pay attention, as well as let the planning commissioners know that we have a clock and we need to continue moving forward. So when you run into potential continuances and or second hearings, because there are applications that do warrant a second hearing, whether additional information needs to be brought in to deliberate and or discuss, that you just have to definitely remember that 120-day rule. Extensions can be granted by the applicant through a written request. In my time in the Dalles, we ran into a very tight situation, and luckily the applicant was willing to give us staff an additional 30 days to process our application. What happens if the city does not act within 120 days, or the county within 150? The applicant can file what they call a writ of mandamus in a local circuit court, which basically requires that the I think it just, it forces the local jurisdiction to approve and or process the permit. And Gordon, maybe you can jump in a little bit more and provide a little more detail on what that...
The court does.
What the court does.
What the court would do is the court would compel the local government to approve the project. But the there are, it would allow application of what are called reasonable conditions of approval, and it wouldn't compel approval if the project was, you know, blatantly not in conformance with the comprehensive plan. But those would be decisions made by the court, not by the planning commission or city or county. So that's not a situation you want to be in.
Right. So it kind of takes away your local authority on making a decision. Findings. So Tamara kind of talked about the way that you guys handle findings here at Boro County. Findings include a statement of relevant facts, how each approval criterion is satisfied by those facts, and then the facts replied upon for the decision. Purposes of findings include aiding in careful consideration by criteria by the reviewing body, and then establishing what evidence that the reviewing body is relied upon. And then explaining the conclusions and how they're supported by the substantial evidence that's included in that application.
I always say that the more complicated the application, the more complicated the findings.
Yeah.
And if it's a really simple application, we don't need to write 12 pages. One or two sentences per standard is fine.
And I will say, when I first became a planner, I really took the whole findings, you have to write a findings document, and you're like, do I need to hit every section of the code? And they're like, well, you need to address most things. So I think once you get, I mean, you have your design criteria and siting criteria, things like that, you will end up, and obviously if your planning commission wants you guys to add a little bit more or to address a certain portion or section of your code, you could also add that to it.
And if it's contentious, we need to make sure that our findings will withstand legal scrutiny.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Finding, there's just some tips, and I think this kind of Daisy jumped right into this. So identify all the applicable criteria, within reason, like Tamara mentioned. Address each criterion separately, so usually calling out the section code, how what the applicant has applied, and how their application either meets or does not meet that criterion. State the fact that leads to the conclusion. Where there's inconsistent evidence, state whether conflicting evidence, but the hearing body believes certain evidence for certain reasons. So sometimes you'll get an application where staff may write, do you write neutral staff reports at times where you don't give a recommendation, or do you always give a recommendation?
We usually write neutral, but the application, 90% of the applications that we process, we have a pretty good idea that they'll meet all the criteria.
Right.
Otherwise, we just informally say, you might want to go back and adjust it so it doesn't.
Great. So articulate the link between the project impact and the conditions being imposed. Put them in clear and understandable language. I think that's key for every planning commissioner. Common problems with findings, failure to address each criterion, deferring a necessary finding to a condition of approval. And I was extremely guilty of that as a planner. You'd be in the midst, you would deem an application complete, and you would be in your review, and you're like, oh no, they didn't do this.
Uh-huh.
And then you would end up adding a condition of approval. So usually staff is trying to make sure that you get those done before. Obviously the Planning Commission can require a condition of approval in order to make sure a criterion is being met. Generalized or making a conclusion without sufficient facts. A word that I've read in some staff reports is I feel or I believe.
Yeah,
and we definitely need to avoid those and make sure that you do have those facts. And then failure to establish causal relationships between facts and conclusions. Burden of proof. This is a big one, and this is really hard for some applicants to hear. Burden of proof is on them. That is completely on them, that all applicable criteria must be met by that applicant. They must submit a complete application with substantial evidence showing they're in compliance with each applicable criterion of the code. They're responsible to respond to all issues raised by any opponents by pointing to evidence in the record and bringing forward more evidence if necessary. And that's sometimes what you'll end up with. You'll have a planning commission hearing, and then someone will bring up something that is contrary or a question that hasn't been addressed in the application, and then they're required to bring that additional evidence. Applicants should not rely on staff presentations alone to meet the burden. What a good thing to do is to ensure that the application includes, it, sometimes when it's a site and you're dealing with a development proposal, photos of that site, as well as, you know, maps, etc. Just that's where more is better. If the applicant provides any new information at a hearing, the public must be given a chance to rebut it. But the city or county cannot use matters not part of an approved criteria to make a judgment on the application. So that's, you know, one of those things in writing staff reports. Sometimes comments come in prior to a public hearing, and then they're brought to the Planning Commission. And this kind of goes back to that education component, is educating the public as to what comments that they should be making or can be making on a land use application. It can't be, I don't want that next door to me. It is because it's going to cause a certain impact, or I don't believe it's going to meet this criterion. So it does have to actually be criterion in order to make a judgment. This kind of jumps into the continuance and keeping the record open. So this is the first hearing, mandatory if requested by the applicant or anyone else prior to the close of the first evidentiary hearing, a minimum of 7 days. This is where I kind of reiterate the 120, 150 day rule. You definitely need to watch that clock. Unless requested by the applicant, the clock is going to continue to roll. Figure out where the hearing will pick up and make it clear when granting the continuance at a said date and time. And then gave a couple scenarios there, just making sure that you have certain amount of time to get additional written information and comments, a certain specified time for rebuttal or opportunity to address new information, and then for the applicant to address any issues that are raised by opponents.
We typically hold it over to the following month.
Yes, and I think it's very typical, or going to a next regularly scheduled meetings. Sometimes you run into, when you're on a crunch for the 120, 150 day, sometimes you'll end up having to ask your planning commissioners if they'll do a special hearing, special meeting. Do you guys, have you run into any time clocks?
It's been quite a few years.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. That is great. That's great to hear. Raise it or waive it. Obviously, we feel this is a very important one that we want to bring across. If a local government has provided proper notice, participants must raise issues during that local proceeding. Any issues not waived or not raised are waived, and the matter is appealed if the matter is appealed to LUBA, which LUBA is Land Use Board of Appeals. Impartial tribunal. The hearing body must be free of personal interest or bias concerns that question whether tribunal is impartial, is ex parte contact, conflicts of interest or bias. And this is, I'm going to let Gordon jump in and finish up talking about these three items here.
Okay, you go on the first. Our first item is ex parte contacts. So if we can go to that.
Sorry, here we go.
Okay, and remember, this is for quasi-judicial hearings, and the key when we say quasi-judicial, the word is judicial. You say you are the equivalent or close to the equivalent. That explains the quasi of a judge in a courtroom. And would a judge in a courtroom? Would it be appropriate for the judge to talk to someone outside the courtroom about the hearing or the matter that's before him as him or her as a judge? No, it wouldn't. And it's similar for you as a quasi-judge for a quasi-judicial hearing. You're making a decision. And what an ex parte contact is, contacts by a party on a fact or issue under circumstances which do not involve all parties to the proceedings. Those ex parte contacts can be oral or in writing. If you receive a letter about an application you're going to hear, that would be, or a handwritten note even, or an oral if you're accosted around your business, around the city or county by someone about an issue. The thing is that they're discouraged even when they occur. We'll talk about what happens if they do occur, because inevitably they do at times. You really want all the facts and issues to be talked about in the public hearing process, your actual meeting. And then what you need to do if the ex parte contact occurs and you need to take action to address the issue, and we'll talk about that. If we go to the next slide.
Gordon,
how to handle if you...
quick question on, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but with if there's an issue that's being discussed on social media, with if there's like a controversial land use application or like a CUP that's being discussed on Facebook, and one of the planning commissioners reads opinions or comments about that, is that considered ex parte contact that needs to be disclosed?
Good question.
Absolutely, yes. Any oral or written contact, and that includes electronic writing, online writing, is an ex parte contact that situation. It doesn't, like I said, it doesn't disqualify the person from participating, but what the cure to an ex parte contact is disclosure at the actual public hearing where the matter is being considered. In your situation, the disclosure would be that, oh, I read a Facebook thread or a Twitter, I guess X Twitter thread or something like that about an item, and I need to disclose that. And so what you need to do in that situation is to disclose on the record at the next hearing on the matter. In other words, if you're in the middle of it, you've had a hearing and you continue it to the next hearing, and then the ex parte context occurs in between those two hearings, then you disclose it at the second hearing within this next subsequent hearing. And that disclosure has to occur before any testimony or proceedings. I think it can occur after, though, that initial reading of the rules by the chair, but before taking testimony or a staff report or anything like that. The commissioner needs to describe the substance of the contact or the communication. It doesn't need to be in great detail, but enough to know what happened. There needs to be a note in the record of the hearing that there was an ex parte contact made and the nature of it. And most importantly, you have to provide the parties a right to comment on the statement or the communication. And for example, if you were to disclose, oh, I noticed there was this application is controversial, and I was going through my social media thread. Feed is the word, and read a whole bunch of stuff about this, and then realized, oops, I shouldn't have been doing that. Then parties, the applicant or someone else who's at the hearing, has to be given the right to ask you about, what did you read? In other words, they can quiz you about it, and you have to be forthcoming in terms of responding to that.
How is that any different than reading a newspaper article?
And it's the same thing as reading a newspaper article. If you read a newspaper article on the subject, you need to say, I read this newspaper article in this newspaper. It said more or less, don't approve this project. I read it, and I will have no basis. I'm not going to take it into account when making the decision. The other thing I would say, a site visit is unfortunately perhaps an ex parte contact, because when you're considering an application involving a site, it is very important, and it can be important to go actually look at the site. If you're looking at a land division of 20 lots and you want to go see how steep the property is, nothing beats, pictures aren't worth pictures are worth 1,000 words, but going out and seeing it is worth 1,000 pictures sometimes. And so, when you do that, you need to disclose that you went out to the site and maybe just briefly what your observations were. I noticed that the land was sloping steeply down from the road. And maybe the applicant will get up there and say, well, I just want to let you know that I've done an analysis and the slope's only 13%, and your standard is the slope can't be greater than 20% for a lot. That would be the kind of thing where someone would have the ability to answer your disclosure. We can go back a second to the site. I think there was one other matter. You have to state on the record in detail what was observed, who was talked to, what was discussed during the site visit. And there are some lawyers who recommend commissioners not do site visits at all because of this issue, and I would never recommend that. I think that it's important a lot of times, as I said, to go look at a site and to help you make a decision. It's just you need to disclose that.
I agree, Gordon. I also, being a lot of these, especially Eastern Oregon, small communities, and a lot of these places are places we drive by every day and that you visit and or are is adjacent to a place you visit. So it's kind of difficult to not avoid doing that. So I agree completely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that would be an example of an ex parte contact. I drive by the site on my normal way to work every day, and I haven't come to any conclusion based upon those drive-bys.
How could you interface it that I've come to no conclusion if you've seen it your whole life and you understand the topography or the impacts of it? I mean, how can you say that won't impact your decision? That makes no sense.
Well, that would be up to you to make that disclosure. You could say, I've driven by it every day of my life, or every 5 days a week for the past 12 years, except when I was on vacation. And I've noticed that the site has a house on it, and there's a stream running through the back of it. I mean, that would be a perfectly good ex parte disclosure. I think that's a good point, is that if you have made an, if driving by it a lot has made an impression on you, you need to disclose that impression.
And then whether or not you still think, based on that site visit, you can make an unbiased decision, right?
I don't even know if you need to say that. I think that it's a given that you will be making an unbiased decision. You've just made a disclosure about some fact about the site that you've noticed, and then maybe someone gets up and says, "Well, that creek isn't really a creek. It doesn't have water in it 300 days of the year." And at that point, maybe the chair would step in and say, "Well, we'll be determining that as part of the proceedings. We'll look at those kind of issues, but the disclosure's been made, and we'll go forward from here." So now I want to talk about conflicts of interest, and this is a matter that's set forth in state law. It's a state law requirement that that sets forth what a conflict of interest is and what has to be done if there is a conflict of interest. And this particular state law is policed by the Oregon Ethics Commission. And so if you run afoul of these statutes, you can be subject to civil penalties from the Oregon Ethics Commission if they do an investigation. So it's very important that you get this straight. A conflict of interest involves, this is the first point to make, is that it involves a pecuniary benefit or detriment. In other words, a financial interest. It does not, we'll get into things that aren't financial interest. There's a category called bias, which is not subject to a statute in state law, but conflicts of interest are, and they involve a financial potential conflict or actual conflict. And so that is defined as a decision that could be a potential conflict of interest, as opposed to an actual conflict of interest, is one that could be to the private pecuniary benefit or detriment of not just you, but also a relative of yours. And the statute has a long list of what a relative is. At some point, second cousins aren't relatives for purposes of the statute, but spouses are, and you can look it up in terms of where exactly that is. A member of your household, in other words, someone who's not related to you but lives in your household, or a business that you have that could be a benefit or detriment to your business. If there is a potential conflict of interest, the law states that you must declare that you have this potential conflict of interest, but then you get to decide whether you are going to participate in the decision, action, or recommendation going forward. For example, a classic one would be, there's a proposed land division of 20 acres or 10 acres on the edge of town, and you own a house a quarter mile away from that proposed subdivision. Well, that could have an impact on the value of your property, but a quarter mile away is probably, or even like 500 feet away, or even maybe even next door. It may or may not have a financial impact on you and your property. And so you would declare, I have a potential conflict of interest, but I don't believe it will have an impact on my decision in this particular case, and so I'm not going to recuse myself or excuse myself from the proceedings. Or perhaps you decide it does. But it's your decision to make. So let's go to the next slide, which is going to be the actual conflict of interest. And this is a decision made by a person acting public official, which would be to the private pecuniary benefit or detriment of those categories of people. In that situation, you have to declare the conflict of interest and you cannot participate in the decision, action, or recommendation. The classic example for this would be if you were the actual applicant for that subdivision of 10 acres, clearly you're going to need to step down, you have a conflict of interest. The applicant is your son who is applying to expand his business. And you are, you are a partial owner. You have an interest in the business. That's an actual conflict of interest and you need to step down and not participate in the decision, action, or recommendation.
Build a house or houses, and you were the contractor and had been contacted by the people trying to divide the ground, that if it was divided, you were going to build the houses there?
That's a great question, and I think in that situation, that would probably be considered an actual conflict of interest, and you would step down. On the other hand, if there were three or four contractors in town, and you had a chance to get that business, but it hadn't been guaranteed to you by the owner of the property, that would be a potential conflict of interest, I think. And then you would decide whether you could be fair enough in that situation. That would be your decision to make. But the key point is, in either of these things, the worst thing you could do is not disclose it to begin with, the actual or potential conflict of interest. And it sometimes means you need to think about the implications of the application as to you personally and your financial interests. And so that there's some thought there. But once you've decided there is a conflict, whether it's an actual or potential conflict of interest, there are a lot of gray areas, and you as an individual have the ability to make that determination and decide whether, first of all, whether you think it's an actual or potential conflict of interest, and secondly, if it's a potential conflict of interest, whether you would feel that you are unbiased enough to continue with the application.
I highly recommend the Oregon Ethics Commission is awesome. They're like a huge resource. And like when I was on the Salem Planning Commission, and I also worked for like a local firm, I had times where I would just call them up and say like, hey, that my firm submitted testimony on this like legislative item. Is that an actual or potential conflict of interest? And they would walk me totally through. They would just take like half an hour to walk me through the laws behind it in order to inform my decision of whether or not it was an actual or potential conflict of interest. So they are actually a huge resource, and if they have like their phone number that you can get, and they're just like a very open like body. So
Gordon, thanks, Daisy. Gordon, can you talk about conflict of interest on legislative matters? Because it's different if it's a legislative matter versus a quasi-judicial proceeding.
Well, it's less likely, but there are possibilities. For instance, if you're considering a code amendment that would allow a duplex on every lot in the city that's zoned for single-family residential development, and you're a builder, and you may or may not specialize in duplex building, I think that, we'll say you're a builder in town, you would, you have a contracting business and you would benefit from a sudden upsurge in the construction of duplexes. I think that would be a potential conflict of interest and you would need to disclose that. I'm sure there's a scenario where you could think of an actual conflict of interest. Maybe one would be that there's a, you own the only type of, you own the only hardware store in town, and there is a proposal to rezone an area where the hardware stores were not allowed to allow hardware stores. That might get into an actual conflict of interest, and it's a legislative matter, so it's possible. It's less likely, but it's possible.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. What do you do if you have an actual conflict of interest? You announce the conflict prior to participating in the hearing, and you refrain from participating in a debate on the issue or voting on the issue. The declaration goes to the minutes of the hearing. The announcement's made at each meeting the matter's on the agenda, And while it's not required, it's recommended that you leave the hearing room after making the declaration and you can return from the next agenda item. It's not technically not allowed, but it's not a good look if you step down and then you're sitting in the audience, kind of, you know, someone's going to say, what are you doing? Are you doing hand signals up to the other commissioners or something like that? Who knows? There are people, you know, if you were the actual applicant or you know, say you were opposed to a development and because it had a financial benefit, and some people say, well, I have the right as a citizen to testify as a citizen. And yes, I guess technically you do, but you don't, it's not recommended that you do that. If you do have an actual conflict of interest, it's best to just step out of the room and wait and come back when the next item is going to be heard.
Even if it's your own application?
Go ahead.
Even if it's your own application and you are a board member, you should not have any.
Well, I would say an exception in that case. If you're the applicant, you could, you know, I mean, you have a right to be the applicant in that situation. But short of that, I would step out of the room. The next slide. There is one exception to an actual conflict of interest. It would be very rare. If an official's vote is necessary to make the minimum number of votes to take official action. In other words, there's seven planning commissioners and only four of you are there, and one of you has an actual conflict of interest. You can be drafted to step up and take a vote even if you have an actual conflict of interest, but you're still not allowed to participate in any discussion or debate on the issue. And like I said, this is very rare, but it is the one exception when you have an actual conflict of interest. We go to the next slide. Okay, well, and once again, back to the potential conflict of interest, you need, and we don't have a slide for that, but you just remember you need to declare it, but then you can decide whether you want to step down from the dais or not. And if you do step down, you should leave the room. You should treat it as if it were an actual conflict of interest. But if it's a potential, it's the main thing is you declare that there is a potential conflict of interest, but you don't believe it'll prevent you from making an unbiased decision on the matter. So now the question is, there's another category of bias. This are the issues that have to do when there's not a financial interest involved, but there's something involved in the application that will influence your ability to make an impartial decision. The classic example I can think of is the application is from a religious institution to expand its facility, and you're a member of that church or religious institution. You don't have a financial interest in that, but you do obviously, most likely, have a personal bias issue. And there's no statute on this, so it is much more of a fluid situation, but there is some case law on this, and what's required is that you, similarly to a conflict of interest issue, you have to disclose before the hearing begins the nature of the bias, state whether or not it requires you to disqualify yourself, and then once again, it's your decision to make whether to step down or not in any issue of bias. You could say in the situation I gave you that, yes, I'm a member of the church, they're applying for this, but I have vowed to be impartial. I'm going to look at the code provisions and not make any personal bias judgments based upon the fact that I'm a member of this, I attend this religious institution. And in that situation, you are allowed to go forward. Now, once again, though, if during the hearing you start showing indices of personal bias when viewing the application, and people think you do, that could cause the ability to appeal that decision. And if there was enough evidence in the record that your personal bias prevented you from making an unbiased decision, that could result in having to redo the hearing without you. So it's something to consider. And that's why we say if there's a sufficient quorum to conduct business without the participation of a commissioner who's been challenged for bias, and that's another matter. If your county does that, but a lot of local governments do have a provision in their local codes that allow an individual commissioner to be challenged for bias or conflict of interest, and then you have to answer that. If there is ability to do that quorum without the participation of that commissioner, you should consider recusing yourself just so that there's not something else, especially if it's a controversial application, there's not something else that could derail the whole process in the future if it went to the Land Use Board of Appeals. But that's a decision for you to make, not someone else.
So if you're on the board of a nonprofit, would you have a conflict of interest or would you have a bias?
Unless you're an employee of the nonprofit, if you were just a board member serving as a volunteer basis, that would be a bias issue, not a conflict of interest.
Some of us have opinions and bias on a lot of subjects.
My hard part is like when my client or someone who is in one of our insurance is an
applicant.
Yeah, because I don't really benefit other than they pay the premium at the end of the day if it's something to do with that. So I guess that's where I sometimes run into, even if it's not somebody I represent, but I know what company does. And I don't really like to. That's a hard one because it's also
confidential information. Yeah, right, for sure.
So Gordon, the chair is talking about if she has a customer.